Hey everyone, welcome once again to the forum, where science comes to socialize. Barbara, Cleo, and I are excited to have you with us at the Institute on Science for Global Policy today.
We'll be even more excited when you communicate with us via social media.
Especially since you guys are the ones impacted by the science and society issues that we discuss here on the show. It's only natural that you'd have something to say about the topics at hand.
So we actually have some breaking news to share with you guys. The forum officially has its own Twitter handle, so break out your smartphones because you can now find us on Twitter at ISGPForum.
You should still use the hashtag ISGPForum, though, so that other social media connoisseurs can easily locate your comments.
But wait, there's more. The forum also has its own Facebook page now. So go like us at ISGPTheForum.
And despite the fact that you can now communicate with our show directly, do yourself a favor and continue to check up on the Institute on Science for Global Policy's Twitter and Facebook accounts. That's where you'll find info on our upcoming conferences.
Okay, so now that's over with, let's get started. Today's episode will focus on a conference that was held as part of our Science and Governance series, which basically means that an ISGP conference was held for a governing body.
That's right. And we started the Science and Governance series in the Houses of Parliament in London. Go big or go home, right?
Yeah, I'm super bitter that I wasn't part of ISGP yet when that program happened.
Tell me about it. Anyway, the conference we're talking about was held in September of 2013 in conjunction with the Parliamentary Office of Science and Technology. The broad topic up for debate was the genomic revolution.
The paper we'll discuss was written by Dr. Ian Crute, Chief Scientist of the Agriculture and Horticulture Development Board in the UK. He titled his paper, "The Genomic Revolution and Sustainable Management of Infectious Plant Disease, Aligning Policies with Objectives."
Quite the mouthful.
But first, here's a quick reminder of how debates hosted by the Institute on Science for Global Policy actually work. Scientists, in this case Dr. Crute, write short policy position papers and are later subjected to intense questioning by an invited panel of experts, our debaters. Most ISGP conferences are conducted under the Chatham House rule, which means that the debaters cannot be identified by name.
If you'd like to read Dr. Crute's position paper, simply check out our website at www.scienceforglobalpolicy.org.
Before we get started on the specifics of Dr. Crute's paper, maybe it'd be helpful to our audience if we defined the term genomics, or the genome for that matter.
Good idea. So the genome is a full set of genetic material present in an organism. Thus, we typically think of the human genome as the DNA contained in a person's cells.
And for those non-biologists out there, in theory, each cell that makes up an organism contains the same genetic information, barring any mutations.
So the genomic revolution really refers to the explosion of new technologies associated with genomic studies, as well as a better overall understanding of what the genome is, how it works, and what we can do with it.
Besides being the blueprint of life.
Well, let's put it this way. If we can understand how the genome functions, then we can probably use that understanding to treat both animal and plant diseases.
Speaking of, plant diseases were the focal point of Dr. Crute's paper. According to our presenter, plants should be scared, very scared, because they can be infected by tons of pathogens.
That's right. Fungi, bacteria, viruses, viroids, oomycetes.
I'm going to stop you there before you use up the entire alphabet. The point is, all of these types of pathogens can be transmitted from plant to plant in a variety of ways, whether the plants are nearby neighbors or separated by quite a bit of distance.
These transmission vectors include contaminated water or soil, airborne pathogens, animals, or even infected reproductive materials like pollens or fruits.
And considering the amount of food that is shipped all around the world each day, it makes you wonder why plant diseases aren't talked about more frequently.
The debaters actually mentioned how food shipping will increase in the future because populations are growing faster than food production is expanding. This will only hasten global plant pathogen spread.
Thankfully, for the sake of today's conversation, Dr. Kroot decided to narrow the scope of his debate to diseases of food crops, though we shouldn't forget that the things we talk about can also be applied to forests, ornamentals, and all other types of plants.
So Dr. Kroot says that global crop yield and quality losses each year amount to 10 or 15% of total crop production. Take a guess as to the monetary losses associated with that statistic.
Maybe $1 billion?
I don't know. I would say more like $10 billion.
Well, you're both off. It's more than $75 billion. This leads naturally to a huge market for crop protection chemicals, such as fungicides. Cleo?
Sorry, I'm still getting over that $75 billion figure. I mean, come on. But anyway, even if economics aren't your cup of tea, that doesn't mean you shouldn't be concerned about plant disease.
That's true, since everyone has to eat to survive. In that way, human life depends on reliable and predictable crop yields.
And if you're into environmental causes and saving the planet, plant disease also results indirectly in wasteful natural resource use and heightened greenhouse gas emissions per unit of production.
So we clearly want to keep plant diseases from developing and spreading. There are barriers, of course. I mean, if our listeners have learned anything from our past episodes, it's probably that a real solution isn't so easy to find.
One of those barriers is evolution. Here we are, humans trying to control everything and stop diseases from happening, while simultaneously pests will evolve to overcome the preventative measures we come up with.
If you're interested in learning about this specific evolution phenomenon, which we call the development of resistance, be sure to check back at our episode featuring the Ely Klein debate from the Focus on Antimicrobial Resistance conference. This episode was titled Resisting Resistance.
Another challenge we face is that new diseases, or new variations on old diseases, are constantly popping up in regions where they never previously existed, or they're infecting plant species that they never previously infected.
And that's probably because of the globalization trend, constantly moving people, plants, and animals around the world.
Finally, there are challenges associated with social opposition to the use of many plant disease prevention tactics that have been used routinely in the past. We're talking chemical treatments here, and there are handfuls of regulatory standards that need to be met before said chemicals can be developed and used in practice.
It's no surprise that some chemical companies wonder whether developing new chemical treatments, like fungicides, will be financially worth it.
Okay, there are challenges. We get it. So what did Dr. Kroot and the debaters say we should do about them?
Well, for one thing, the debaters agreed that too many countries have a reactionary strategy for combating crop disease. In other words, they try to fix the problem after it happens, rather than prevent disease from occurring in the first place.
Along those lines, Dr. Kroot thinks there are significant opportunities associated with genomic technologies that now have the power to detect and identify pathogenic materials in seeds or other reproductive plant material.
And it's certainly important to plant disease-free seeds from the start, especially when considering perennial plants that are supposed to live and produce for, you know, a while.
Furthermore, genome science now allows us to better understand plant immune systems.
And while we're not trying to keep our plants from getting the flu, per se, we can use this immune system knowledge to identify or construct plant gene sequences that could provide the plant with protection against specific pathogens that it will be up against.
Interesting. A potato plant in Africa would probably be exposed to different pathogens than one in Idaho, so theoretically we could use this technology to prepare these plants for their unique geographical exposures?
That's the idea.
If that's interesting, then wait till you hear this. We've been talking about applying our understanding of the plant genome. Aubrey, why don't you tell Cleo and our listeners what can be done with an understanding of pathogen genomes?
Gladly. Comprehending the genomes of plant pests could help us design new chemical treatments to ward off the pests, but that's not the exciting part. What's really neat is that these treatments could be engineered such that if the pathogen develops resistance, it could result in debilitation or death to the pathogen.
That's definitely an interesting concept. Actually, the debaters felt that people who are squeamish about eating engineered crops might react more favorably toward engineering the pathogens. We have met the enemy, and he shall be engineered to no longer be an enemy.
The debaters agreed wholeheartedly that host-pathogen interactions, which in this case involve the crop and its disease, must be better understood genetically. Cleo, they actually did refer to the plant pests as the enemy.
Really? That's cool.
So a common thread that I'm noticing here is that many solutions or opportunities seem to be associated with genome manipulation. In other words, genetic engineering, genetic modification, GM products.
There it is, the elephant in the room.
Is that elephant genetically engineered?
Probably not.
It would probably be beneficial to define genetic engineering before delving into this part of the debate, just so we're all on an even playing field here.
Good call. Genetic engineering, or genetic modification, is simply defined as the intentional modification of an organism's traits by changing its genetic material. This may include incorporating a gene, or deleting a gene, in order to elicit a desired outcome, like improved crop yield.
Genetic engineering is frequently met with controversy, so I wouldn't be surprised if the following assertion was deemed controversial. Dr. Crute thinks that genome sciences provide us with the ability to more effectively and efficiently produce crops that have socially beneficial traits.
Such as disease resistance.
Exactly. He basically thinks we should harness the power of genetic modification. However, many governments currently place heavy regulations on GM biotechnologies, making R&D in this field financially unsustainable.
For this reason, our presenter called for the deregulation of genetically engineered crops that demonstrate well-established beneficial traits like disease resistance. In other words, and this is the key here, regulations should apply to the characteristics of the end product, not to the procedures used to develop it.
So what you're saying is that if Lab A produces a disease-resistant cereal plant via traditional breeding, and Lab B produces the same plant via genetic engineering, they should both be regulated the same way?
Correct.
In that case, it would surely be advantageous to choose genetic engineering. I mean, that could be accomplished in a few months to a year, whereas traditional plant breeding could take decades to achieve the same result.
The debaters talked about this.
Yeah, they did. They used blight, the common potato disease, as a case study to better understand how genetic engineering accomplishes the same end goal as traditional breeding, but in a much shorter time frame.
In the case of potatoes, it was pointed out that hybridizing potato strains from Europe and Egypt can take 30 to 40 years to achieve the same high yield and disease resistance accomplished by genetic manipulations in a fraction of the time.
But the debaters weren't completely convinced regarding the regulation issue. While they agreed that a blanket regulation at the procedural level was unnecessary, they still thought that technology regulation should occur if and when the change being induced would not occur naturally by traditional breeding.
That's a complicated statement. Basically, it boils down to this. If genetic engineering introduces a trait in a crop that doesn't occur naturally, then the genetic engineering process should be regulated.
There is definitely a difference in opinion here between Dr. Crute and some of the debaters regarding if, when, and how genetically engineered crops should be regulated, especially when compared to traditionally bred crops.
After achieving less stringent regulatory practices, Dr. Crute wants to see an overall genetic improvement of crop plants through shared plant germplasm programs. Hold up. Let me rephrase that since it sounds really complicated. Basically, he wrote that there shouldn't be restrictions on the use of plant seeds for research on how to improve the disease resistance of crops.
What kind of restrictions does he want to prevent?
Well, he doesn't want companies getting intellectual property rights for seeds of a new and improved crop that will be needed to produce other varieties of the crop, or that will be needed as parents for next year's crop.
This seemed to bother some of the debaters at first. They wondered how investors in new technologies would be compensated if the patents weren't granted, among other concerns.
Well, they seemed a little less vexed after it was pointed out that certain regions currently have plant breeders' rights. These rights allow breeders to recover investments by selling seeds without keeping other breeders from using that seed type in parenting new varieties of the crop. While patents might prevent further genetic improvement, plant breeders' rights do not.
Despite this example, though, the debaters maintained that patents will still be necessary in many cases of significant commercial value.
Tough crowd.
Speaking of tough crowds, I was just thinking. The implementation of new types of crops depends so much on public perception. So, are there any examples of GM crops that have had beneficial outcomes that might influence public perception?
Why, yes, Cleo, there are.
The debaters discussed a Bacillus thuringiensis gene, which, when inserted into the genome of a wide array of crops, can confer resistance against consumption by caterpillars.
Bacillus what?
Bacillus thuringiensis. It's a type of bacterium that lives in soil and produces protein crystals, which are toxic to certain insects.
In any case, incorporating a part of its genetic code into some crops has prevented crop destruction at the mandibles of our insect foes.
Debaters also noted that there were positive ecological effects. This application of genetic engineering technology resulted in the use of fewer insecticides, which is good for the environment in general and prevents the murder of harmless insects that were never the target of the insecticides.
And genetic manipulations that enhance crop yield have their own ecological benefits, which some debaters touted as the biggest environmental benefit of all. Namely, high yields should require the use of less farmland, leaving more ground for habitat preservation.
For completeness, we should note that the debaters seem to think that we'll never have a one-size-fits-all approach that overcomes plant diseases. Genetic engineering, surveillance, and chemical pesticides comprised a suite of options that will be applicable in different scenarios.
The conference attendees did note that we're much more likely to see these strategies developed for more important crops, ones that make the food world go round. They're thinking rice, potatoes, cereals, and the like.
Good point. What about orphan crops that are important for local food systems and nutrition, but have little or no commercial value?
Well, a lot of companies are less likely to put time and funding into orphan crop research because of potential market failures. In other words, they could lose money more easily developing genetically modified taro than corn.
Taro? You could pick any random vegetable, and you pick taro?
Don't judge me!
Don't worry, Babs. This is a judgment-free zone. You can have your taro and eat it, too.
Not going to lie, I don't even think I've had taro before. Anyway, Dr. Kroot thinks that neglecting these non-economic crops is a mistake, and that national governments need to direct public funding towards the genetic improvement of minor crops if they're nutritionally important.
And the debaters didn't disagree with this, since local crops are important for maintaining food security. But so are grain-growing regions, and debaters were concerned that since there are so few breadbasket areas in the world, one or two natural disasters in the wrong places at the wrong time could result in widespread food shortages.
Well, they actually wondered if what we're now considering orphan crops could potentially be exploited in the future as global food sources, especially if we're concerned about losing current staples to disease or climate-related issues.
Right. Plant genetic diversity is a resource we could tap to find solutions to food problems caused by our good friend climate change.
We're getting a little off topic, though, so let's get back on track with this question. We seem to have competing interests when we consider scientists, industry, and farmers, so is there any way these groups can work together in this genomic revolution?
Well, they kind of already do in some cases.
Yeah, the case of chocolate.
Chocolate?
She's right, actually. Many companies use cocoa as a raw material, and they could benefit from a better understanding of the cocoa genome. So what happened? A public-private partnership was developed to map the genome and enhance cocoa research.
The 3 million global cocoa farmers make money, the scientists get genomic information to research, and the companies get to commercially take advantage of whatever the researchers deduce.
I believe they call that a win-win-win situation, with an additional win because it involves helping to make more chocolate, which I'm in favor of.
Indeed.
Well, guys, I think we gave the audience a lot to think about today.
We definitely did. And I think a standout point coming out of today's podcast is the fact that there was a lot of contention between debaters and Dr. Kroot during this debate. As you might have predicted as soon as we introduced the GM topic, it was hard to find consensus amongst the group.
Don't despair, though. This is a healthy conversation to have. Whenever you have a controversial technology, it's important for all sides to have a clear understanding of one another before we can hope to establish any reasonable policies.
So, where do you stand on the issue? Is genetic engineering of crops important for ensuring plant safety, food security, or environmental protection?
We encourage you to do your own research, now that you've heard what our presenter and debaters had to say. In the spirit of understanding both sides of the story, your homework today is to read up on genetic engineering.
And in true professor fashion, please do not use Wikipedia.
Once you've done your reading, let us know what you think regarding the topic of today's episode.
Don't forget that you can now find us on Twitter directly at ISGP Forum, and you can communicate with us and the rest of our listeners using hashtag ISGP Forum.
Thanks for taking some time to socialize the science today. We'll see you next time right here on the Forum.
The Institute on Science for Global Policy, or ISGP, is a nonprofit organization that convenes international meetings bringing together scientists, policymakers, industry leaders, students, and other stakeholders to discuss pertinent scientific issues facing society. The ISGP has no opinions and does not lobby. Therefore, the preceding podcast reflects the views expressed by the presenters and debaters at our conference. For more information, please visit our website at www.scienceforglobalpolicy.org. Thank you.